Leslie Silko said, you don't have anything if you don't have the stories. And we come to an amazing story in the Gospel of John this morning, chapter 11, the raising of Lazarus from the dead. This is the last of seven signs in John's Gospels, and it's the climactic sign. You see those lists of the seven signs that appear in John behind me. Lazarus is not the only person that Jesus raised from the dead. We read about Jairus' daughter in Mark 4 and the widow's son in Luke 7, but the Lazarus story is much more detailed and familiar. Up until now in John's Gospel, we've learned that Jesus is the bread of life. He's the water of life. He's the light of life. But now we learn that he gives life. He is the resurrection and the life. And since there's so much in this story, we're going to take this chapter, actually this account, in 2 weeks. Unfortunately, we're going to leave Lazarus in the tomb this morning, but we'll get him out next week. Let me make just a comment about the Gospel of John and its structure. Chapters 11 and 12 actually form a bridge between the first half of the book of signs, and the second half of the book of glory. It's easy to see that chapter 11 helps to conclude the first half of the book. It's the last sign. It marks the end of Jesus' public ministry. The raising of Lazarus takes place just after the discourse of the Good Shepherd and just prior to the Passion Week when Jesus will risk his life by going to Judea. So the story illustrates what the Good Shepherd does. He lays down his life for the flock. And when Jesus speaks to the dead and the dead come out of the tomb, he brings everything to a head and seals his fate. But the chapter also introduces the second half of the book of glory. As we saw last week in chapter 10, Jesus escaped arrest and went to Bethany beyond the Jordan where John was baptizing. And this mention of John and the place, Bethany beyond the Jordan, connects us to chapter 1 and the very first story that we encounter after the prologue, the questioning of John by religious experts from Jerusalem. As I mentioned last week, the end of chapter 10, the story comes full circle and marks this giant inclusio in John's gospel. And chapter 11 now begins with a story that foreshadows Jesus' own death and resurrection. Story begins in verse 1. Now a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. So the sisters sent word to him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. But when Jesus heard this, he said, this sickness is not to end in death, but for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified by it. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that he was sick, he then stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Now in verse 1, we're introduced to a man by the name of Lazarus. The casual style by which John introduces this man signifies that John's readers were familiar with who he was. There are those who think that this story is a retelling of Luke chapter 16, where we find a parable and a man also named Lazarus, but there's no reason not to think that these two stories are separate. Lazarus and his two sisters, Martha and Mary, live in Bethany. And this Bethany and the Bethany beyond the Jordan are actually two different villages. And that's why John characterizes this Bethany as the village of Mary and her sister Martha. The village is located on the east side of the Mount of Olives, less than 2 miles from Jerusalem along the road to Jericho. Bethany beyond the Jordan, however, is quite some distance from where Lazarus and his sisters live. And you see it in that little box there on your map. It's in the region of Bethania. It's on the right side there of the Sea of Galilee, east of the Sea of Galilee. And the river that John was baptizing in is most likely the Yarmouk. And this distance, I think, will play very importantly to help us understand the story. Now, if you've ever been to Jerusalem, one of the things that you might have done is to get up early to watch the sunrise over the city of Jerusalem. It's an amazing, amazing sight. And when you do that, you encounter all kinds of various people up there. We found Drew Shee up there and asked him to come to PBC to help us lead worship. We found Bernard Bell up there as well. It's an amazing place, but it's quite a sight to behold. The other thing that you find on the Mount of Olives is walls and walls of tombs. And the reason for this is that according to Zechariah, the Mount of Olives is supposedly the first place where the resurrection will happen. And so when Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead right near the Mount of Olives, he's already doing it. He's ushering in the new age. Mary in the story is described as the one who poured perfume on the Lord. And this looks forward to the events of the beginning of chapter 12 and presupposes that John's readers have already heard of it. Lazarus is very sick, and his sisters, who are very concerned, send a message to Jesus about their brother. They address Jesus as Lord, in other words, masters. They are his disciples. I'm not sure they're yet making a confession of deity. Lazarus is described in verse 3 as the one whom Jesus loved. And then John adds in verse 5 that Jesus loved not only Lazarus, but Martha and Mary. Jesus will return to Jerusalem under the threat of the Jews because of his love for the family, but also because it was a signal from the Father. There's actually two words here used for love, both phileo and agapao, but John does that sort of thing in his gospel, and there's probably not much distinction. You know, this is a beautiful note here that draws attention to the humanity of Jesus. Jesus had emotions, and he had affections for certain people. Later in the story, we'll see that Jesus weeps. Jesus was not some unfeeling, insensitive, divine robot or theological machine. He cared. He loved. When people hurt, he hurt. Human suffering affected him. And when Jesus went to the cross, we can understand that he experienced the pain and the anguish fully of a human being. This insight by John, I think, helps us to know Jesus in a more human way and perhaps relate to him more clearly. When Jesus received the message about Lazarus, he proclaimed that the sickness is not to death. It doesn't mean that it's not fatal. It means that it will not ultimately end in death. Rather, the sickness is for the glory of God, which is close to what Jesus said in chapter 9. About the blind man, it was neither that this man sinned nor his parents, but it was so that the works of God might be displayed in him. Jesus understands that the purpose and what will soon take place is so that God's glory can be revealed. God's self-disclosure, God's character can be manifested and seen full of grace and truth. Jesus also understands that the Son is to be glorified. And we see in John that both the Father and the Son are committed to one another's glory. Verse 7. Then after this, he said to the disciples, "Let us go to Judea again." And the disciples said to him, "Rabbi, are you out of your mind? The Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and you're going to go there again?" Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, but he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him." So after a couple of days, Jesus announces to the disciples, pack your bags, we're going back to Judea. So, well, chapter 10 ends with the Jews seeking to stone Jesus during the Feast of Dedication. And the disciples are flabbergasted. They cannot believe that Jesus wants to go back to Judea. They fear the threat of the Jews. But then the disciples do not recognize that Jesus' death will be his glorification and the consummation of his ministry. Jesus responds to his disciples by talking about day and night, the same metaphor that he used in chapter 9. Typically, there are 12 hours in the day, plus or minus, depending upon the time of the year. In this culture, people only worked in the day and not in the night, perhaps a lesson that people in Silicon Valley can take to heart. The light of the world is the sun and determines when the workday begins and ends. During the daylight, one can see and work and not stumble. Jesus is telling his disciples that it's still day and he has to continue to do the works of the fathers while it is day. Night is coming. Daylight's going to end soon. But even if daylight is advanced, it would be wrong to quit working before the 12 hours are used up. Jesus is safe as long as it is day and as long as he is doing the Father's will. The light of the world is also Jesus. As long as the disciples have him, they should do the works assigned to them. And this applies to us as well. If we walk in the light, walk in the way of Jesus, walk in the presence of Jesus, we have nothing to fear. Fear comes when we walk in the darkness, when we can't see, and when we're sure to stumble. But as long as we continue to walk in the light of Jesus, it'll be okay. Our times are in God's hands. And then Jesus informs his disciples that Lazarus has died. This he said, and after that he said to them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go so that I may awaken him out of sleep." Notice that he says, "our friend," plural, "but I go," singular, and thus notes the fact that Jesus alone is the resurrection and the life. The disciples then said to him, "Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he'll recover. Don't worry about it." Now, Jesus has spoken of his death, but they thought he was speaking of literal sleep. So Jesus then said to them plainly, "Lazarus is dead. And I am glad for your sakes that I was not there so that you may believe. But let us go to him." Therefore, Thomas, who is called Didymus, which means the twin, said to his fellow disciples, "Let us also go that we may die with him." Well, the disciples don't understand Jesus' metaphor of sleep. Their mindset is on illness, and they basically just do not want to go back to Judea. They think that Lazarus will recover. In other words, he'll be healed, he'll be saved. The word for falling asleep in verse 13 is used only here in the New Testament, but it's a very common expression in the Old Testament for death. We always read, "so-and-so slept with their fathers." Thomas responds with this wild boldness, saying he's willing to go and die with Jesus. In chapter 20, Thomas is going to be labeled as a doubter, but here he shows some sort of courage and devotion. Whether it's blind or not, we're not quite sure. Obviously, Thomas speaks better than he knows, because to follow Jesus means death, laying down our life. We will die, but we will also live. Now, the thing that strikes us about the first part of the story is the delay of Jesus in going to see his friend. Why the delay? We read in verse 6 that Jesus stays 2 days longer in Bethany beyond the Jordan when he hears the news. And verse 17 informs us that when he arrives in Bethany, Lazarus has been in the tomb for 4 days. Now, here's where the geography comes into play. Jesus most likely would have traveled a distance of about 150 kilometers, requiring a journey of almost 4 days. The likely scenario, at least the one I like, is that Jesus hears the news. He delays 2 days until Lazarus dies, which he knows supernaturally. And at that point, he travels to Lazarus' home, and when he arrives, Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. So even if Jesus had left immediately, it's likely that when he would have gotten to the village where Lazarus lived, Lazarus would have been dead already 2 days. But even if Jesus had not gotten to Bethany in time, Jesus loved Lazarus. He could have spoken a word and Lazarus would have been healed, just like the story of the official's son that we read in chapter 4. Both Martha and Mary have the perspective that Jesus could have prevented this death. And so when Jesus comes, they both say the same identical thing. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. So why didn't Jesus come immediately? Well, one thing that we can say is that the rabbis believe the soul hovers over the body of a deceased person for the first 3 days, intending to re-enter it. So after 3 days, death is irreversible. So when Jesus raised Lazarus, after 4 days, there could be no doubt that this was a resurrection and not a resuscitation. But there's so much more that we can say about this delay of Jesus, the non-healing of Lazarus, that has incredible significance in our own spiritual life. And I'm going to mention 4 things this morning. First, God often delays or allows circumstances to happen so we experience the effects of loss and death in one way or another. You know, sometimes we ask for healing. It just doesn't happen. Sometimes we plead with God and God delays. We know that God could heal with a word, but he doesn't do it. We know that God could prevent death, but he doesn't do it. God delays. It's a very difficult truth for us to grasp, but it's true. I mean, look at the stories in the Bible and how prominent God's delaying occurs in these stories. Think about Abraham and Sarah and how long they had to wait for the promise of a son to be fulfilled. Think about the years Joseph waited in Egypt for redemption and reconciliation with his family. Think about Israel in Egyptian bondage and Babylonian exile. When we read the Bible, it's clear to understand that God is never in a hurry to prevent unpleasant circumstances. And this truth is confirmed by our own life, isn't it? And we can point to times in our life where God could have prevented something from happening, but he didn't. Our understanding of God has to be large enough to include this fact about God's delaying, about death, about laying down of our life. Death, it seems, is a necessary condition for true life. And so Jesus will say in chapter 12, "Truly, truly, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone, but if it dies, it bears much fruit." Now, death happens in different ways at different times. I mean, there's the obvious physical and definable ways in which death happens. But so much more takes place within us. You know, I know that I would characterize this dying, this laying down of life in my own life as an inner journey, the downward way of the cross. I define it as a slow burn. I can see how it happened when I was 25, and then 30, and 35, and 40, and 45, and 50. I hope the Lord was done. Then it shows up at 55. And each time the issue is more complicated, and each time it goes deeper and deeper into my heart. We die to a life we wanted, or a life the way we think it should be. We die to our desire for a perfect body, or a cavity-free mouth, or a large home, or fancy vacations. We die to our need for a spouse or a child. We die to our deepest longing for reciprocated love from the one person we most want it from. There are so many ways that life forces us to lay down our life, and God, it seems, does not prevent it. Two, there are a variety of responses and a multitude of motions to death or the laying down of our life. You know, when death happens, we experience fear and anxiety, confusion and doubt. We get angry at God for not preventing what happens or not responding to our prayers as we want. Some of us feel numbness or darkness or depression. Others fill their life so full and keep their life so busy that they just don't have to face reality. Each one of us has a different set of emotions, and each one of us might respond in a different way. But all of us have those emotions, and all of us need to face them openly and honestly. And the reason is that God takes our emotions to stir within us our deepest longings and deepest desires for love, for acceptance, for home, for a place where we belong. The worst thing that we can do, the absolute worst thing we can do, is to deny these emotions or stuff them or to paint death with some glossy, out-of-touch, Christianized slogan. See, God wants to use these things in our life to crack open our heart so that He Himself can have access to the deepest, deepest part of us. Three, God's delays do not mean that He does not love us, but that He has higher purposes for our life. The text is very clear to point out that Jesus loved Lazarus. He was crazy about him. And also the sisters Martha and Mary. It is so clear that John uses two different words for love, phileo and agapao, to indicate to us his comprehensive love for this family. Jesus' delay is ultimately for the good of Lazarus, his sisters, his disciples, and the people who come from Jerusalem to be witnesses. The delay, he says, is tied to believing. Jesus tells the disciples that he rejoices because they will believe. In the face of human suffering, Jesus is not indifferent. He too suffers. But God's will and God's purposes take a higher priority than our personal happiness. God, in his wisdom, will do what will be for his glory. And Jesus says he rejoices in it. In the end, he will be glorified. And it will be for our glory and our good. God is so much for us that he is willing to delay and endure painfully our dying to self so that we can experience something so much greater. And that, my friends, is resurrection, resurrected life. It's a life that we could never have without God, and it's a life that we can never have without death. See, if God loved us so much while we were enemies and while we were sinners, how much more will God love us as we face the different circumstances and situations in our life that force us to let go of the life of this world to grab hold of the life of Jesus? Can we accept the fact that God is using the events in our life so that we will live a believing life, a resurrected life? Can we accept the fact that God delays in order to reveal His glory for the good of other people? In other words, your life is not about you. What's happening to you might might be occurring so that another person might see the glory of God revealed in you, a friend, a family member, a workmate, a neighbor, a child down the street, maybe even an enemy. Can we accept the fact that God wants to use our life for a higher goal and purpose than our own personal happiness? Are we willing to believe? The community that believes in these higher purposes and goals is the community that will be transformed by the light of Jesus into the glory of God. And finally, while we wait for God's arrival, we can do so with the hope and confidence of God's commitment and love and purposes towards us. Frederick Buechner writes, "Faith cannot be sure of things happening the way it wants because it is God who makes things happen the way God wants. Faith can only wait in hope and trust. Sometimes God makes himself known by his presence, sometimes by his absence." Henry Nouwens writes, "The root choice is to trust at all times that God is with you and will give you what you most need." As we wait for God to fulfill his plans, we have a choice. One choice is to live complaining, arguing, fighting, fearing, and trying to force life in our own strength and understanding. These are signs of not trusting and not believing. I confess I know these signs very well in my own life. The other choice is to wait patiently, to hope fervently, and to love compassionately. These are the signs of believing. And the scriptures are full of encouragements to sustain us when fear and darkness and temptation would creep into our hearts. Our scripture reading this morning from Lamentation. "This I recall to my mind, therefore I have hope. The Lord's loving kindnesses indeed never cease, for his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. For the Lord will not reject forever, for if he causes grief, then he will have compassion according to his abundant loving kindness." And God's loving kindness is huge. Therefore, his compassion is huge. The psalmist writes, "I would have despaired unless I had believed that I would see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living." So wait for the Lord. Be strong and let your heart take courage. Yes, wait for the Lord. "I wait for the Lord. My soul does wait, and in his word do I hope. My soul waits for the Lord more than the watchman for the morning, indeed more than the watchman for the morning. O Israel, hope in the Lord. With the Lord there is loving kindness, and with him is abundant redemption, for he will redeem Israel from all his iniquities. The Lord may delay, but he's going to come." It's hard. It's hard when God delays, when he doesn't prevent things from happening in our life. But it seems that it is necessary if we truly, truly desire to experience resurrection life, not just in the age to come, but right now in the present. And that's our belief. This is our confession. That in all of our failure and frailty, all of our weakness and wickedness, God gives life. Let's sing. "And now, Lord, for what do I hope, or what do I wait? My hope is in you. Let our song be today, Give Me Jesus.